This episode from Russia with Love, Tetris. So this story begins in the Soviet Union with a young researcher by the name of Alexei Pajitnov. And he was working with artificial intelligence at the Moscow Academy of Science. And, well, not exactly working, because he was also messing around with designing a puzzle game based on a puzzle video game based on an actual puzzle game called Pentominoes. And eventually this game becomes Tetris. But Pentominoes is a kind of brain teaser puzzle with different permutations, different shapes that you have to arrange into separate blocks. And it's sort of a geometry puzzle or a riddle. Now, Pajitnov places this game into a video game setting where the blocks fall from the top of the screen and players have to rotate them and place them and form a line. I think everybody's familiar with that. Tetris is on literally every console. If you can find a game system that doesn't have Tetris on it, released after 1990, I would be surprised. Agreed. Maybe like the Atari Jaguar or something.
Maybe. I don't think Jaguar has it, actually. You're right.
Probably not. But after that, I mean, everything has Tetris on it. Even Tetris 3D is on, like, the N64. Pajitnov builds this game on what's called an Electronica 60, which is essentially a clone of a PDP system. We saw this a little bit earlier with Space War on the PDP-1. So this is sort of a successor to it. It's the equivalent of a PDP-11. It's a Russian sort of clone or version of it. But it wasn't really a games manufacturing system. It was designed probably for some sort of military application or geometric computations. So it really can only do alphanumeric characters. Alexei sends his game to a Russian hacker friend named Vadim Gerasimov, to put the game onto more mainstream PCs and make it look better. And after that, that's what we get to be known as Tetris today. So Tetris's development continues on after that, and it becomes an interesting story because Pajitnov develops this game mostly on the Russian Soviet government's time. And there is no intellectual property rights law in the Soviet Union. So that becomes kind of a difficult thing to navigate, especially once the game becomes popular and monetized in the West. So,
yeah, definitely. Just quickly on the Jaguar, somebody did make a homebrew. They call it Jagtris.
Of course they did.
Well, I mean, as you were saying, I mean, you were right, though. It was never really developed at all for Jaguar at the time. So what happens with this game then is it's put on floppy disk, and Pajitnov's supervisor, this guy named Brodjbrin, I believe. I can't even really pronounce it. But he starts to send it out to developers in Poland. And I believe also he gets it out to Hungary. And there's this guy in Hungary at the time, but I believe he's English, and his name is Robert Stein, and he's an international software salesman. So he sees it, and he wants to make a move on it for his own company. So what happens is he reaches out to Pajitnov and his supervisor via a fax transmission to try to obtain the rights to Tetris in order to bring it to the Western market. He sees it. He realizes this thing could be a juggernaut and I can make money off it. Pajitnov and his supervisor get back to him, to Robert Stein, via fax, telling them they're interested in coming to some type of agreement with Stein. And so little did the two Russians know at the time, but the fax communication back to Stein from them is considered some sort of a legal contract or the start of a legal contract in the Western world. So Stein sees this, gets this, and he runs with it because he wants to get it to other companies for production. He brings the game to the 1987 Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas, there's a lot of companies who are skeptical of a Soviet game doing anything but obviously failing in the West because it's a Soviet game. It's Russians. It's made by commies, right? So he ends up selling the rights to a European publisher named Mirasoft and an American publisher named Spectrum Holobyte. Stein gets the equivalent of something like $5,000 or $6,000 plus 7.5% to 15% on sales of the game. It literally goes on to sell over 100,000 units in the first year on PC computers like the Amiga, the Atari ST, the ZX Spectrum, and the Commodore 64. The only problem is that Stein sells the license for a game he technically doesn't own yet. So he automatically then goes back and contacts Pajitnov again and asks him for a full contract for the rights, offering 75% of the revenue that Stein generates from the license. It doesn't sound like a bad deal. But going back to what Chris said, there's no intellectual property. So Pajitnov kind of knows that he really can't do this.
Yeah, because he technically doesn't own it.
Right. So the commies own it. So in steps ILORG, which is the Soviet's central organization for the import and export of computer software, and they request 80% from Stein. Stein makes several trips back and forth to negotiate and finally gets a deal with ILORG for it's a 10-year worldwide license for a Tetris game. Now, at this time, Pajitnov and his supervisor have no idea the game is already being sold. It's already being sold across all these PC platforms. And Stein has been claiming the rights to the game the entire time. Pajitnov gets nothing from this whatsoever. Fast forward a little bit, Spectrum Holobyte sells their Japanese rights to Hank Rogers, who's, you know, a software dude, whatever. He's got a very, very close relationship with Nintendo. Mirasoft sells their Japanese rights to Atari's subsidiary, Tengent, who then, of course, sells their rights to Sega and their console rights to BPS, which is the Famicom. This all gets super duper jumbled. People are basically just selling the rights back and forth, and no one really knows who's supposed to own it or who even started with it or owned it to begin with.
You know, people end up selling the rights that they barely have.
Right.
Slight relation to
well,
it.
Well, so is it technically under the Soviet Union?
Yes, that's like, why ILORG, which is the Soviets, you know,
yeah, they're
software people, right? They step in. They're like, whoa, slow down. This guy was, you know, messing around on, you know,
our time.
Communist time. That's our time, we own it. You know, yeah, he's like,
different time
look,
zone.
He's messing around on Soviet time, so we actually own it.
Yeah, it's owned by the people of the Soviet Union.
Right, whatever. So now...
People's Republic of the Soviets.
That's different.
Atari now releases it to the arcades in 1988, which is a two-player version of it, which I love. I think it's an awesome version of it. A lot of people tend to go with the later versions of it on the consoles. But in 1989, Hank Rogers, again, he goes to the Soviets at ILORG to negotiate the handheld rights for Nintendo and their Game Boy. Before he makes this trip, Rogers had tried to contact Stein several times to no avail. Rogers then realizes, as he kind of goes back on this game, he realizes that Stein pulled some kind of sketchy stuff, right? Okay. So he already realizes that Stein probably did a lot of stuff outside of contract, that he did a lot of stuff when he didn't actually have the license for it. He realized it. He goes back to the Soviets. He throws Stein under the bus to the Soviets, renegotiates a huge contract with the Soviets for Nintendo to get the handheld and console contract back to Nintendo's Minoru Arakawa, and he gets that license for $500,000 up front to the Soviets, and then 50 cents per cart sold.
Okay, so this is Nintendo properly getting the license.
Or are they?
Okay. Yeah.
Because
exactly.
Here's the problem then. You fast forward, they go on, Nintendo comes back, and they decide to, in 1989, they decide to battle Atari. Because Atari is already forging ahead with releasing the Tengen version of Tetris on the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Well, yeah, there's a whole thing with
right.
all of that.
So they're fighting about this. Atari goes back and forth with them. The judge ends up ruling in favor of Nintendo and grants them an injunction against Atari games. And literally on June 22nd, 1989, Atari withdraws its NES version from sale. And then what happens is roughly, I think what I see is there's a quote from somebody in this book I have open. I have this great book, The Ultimate History of Video Games by Stephen Kent, and I love referencing it. And Ted Hoff says, there were 268,000 of those cartridges locked up in Milpitas, California on Sycamore Street, and they were just not for sale. So now you fast forward into collecting market, the Tengen Nintendo cartridge, complete in box, fetches anywhere between $150 and $300 or even yeah. more than that to this day, because people find it to be the more pure version of it. Nintendo obviously, you know, puts out, but theirs is a one-player version where Tengen's is a two-player version. So what happens is, you know, Ted Hoff says, if people knew that they were $300 each and knew that there were that many of them, they probably would have picked a lock. But that was all that was a well-kept secret in a dark room. And those cartridges, 268,000 of them, were never shipped. When he had left the company, the cartridges were still under lock and key. And his understanding was that they were to be subsequently destroyed. 268,000 cartridges yeah. were going to be subsequently destroyed because of their loss of this legal case. But I'm going to let you guys and Chris talk to what happens then when Nintendo, you know, when Hank Rogers sees it and he realizes they need something for the launch of their new handheld console, Nintendo. Basically, what happens after that?
Yeah, well, I want to talk a little bit more about the Atari Nintendo thing, because okay. also part of that story was also, and I don't know if it was in that lawsuit, it probably was, Nintendo had this kind of crazy licensing system with the NES where they forced developers to basically deliver them their game, and then Nintendo would handle all of the manufacturing. They would collect all the profits, and then they would yeah. give something to the developer.
Yes.
So that's why, I mean, all the NES cartridges look the same. And the other thing is, all of them, there was a limit on how many games you could release in a year.
I think it was 5 per year to start.
I think so.
That's crazy.
That's yeah. the number that Konami started with, and what's that failed Long Island company? Acclaim started with that
yeah.
as well.
Acclaim was on Long Island.
From Long Island?
Acclaim was in Port Washington, dude.
That's crazy.
I know plenty of people
who worked at Acclaim in Port Washington, mm-hmm. and when it went under, they got to work that day it went under, and there was literally a sign on the door that said, yeah. "You're out of a job. We're closed. Goodbye." And some of them didn't even get a final paycheck.
They might not have had the money to pay him.
Yeah, that was probably half the problem. But so with Tengen and Nintendo, you know, Atari didn't like that. So what they wanted to do was release as many games as they wanted. So they end up suing Nintendo. And I think part of that was also the Tetris thing, because that was their kind of big other game, was they wanted to release their own version of Tetris that Nintendo had already released. Nintendo said no, they released it on different looking cartridges, those black ones that the Tengens yeah. came in.
And yeah, with the little tab at the top?
Yeah, the little tab yeah. at the top and stuff like that.
And according to Atari, Tengen, they have the rights to
they
it,
own
right?
The rights to
like,
it.
They
yeah.
own the yeah. rights to it, right?
Yeah,
so,
they,
yeah,
yeah. Technically, you know, yeah. they have... Did they have an actual piece of paper, or did they have...
Yes, they did.
Yeah, so they had a piece of paper that said that they had the rights. Yeah. So they definitely feel entitled to it.
Yeah. So eventually that fails. And I know the Genesis version of Tetris is also very expensive, probably because of something similar to that, because I think it was put out by Atari.
Well, they had planned to release a Genesis version of Tetris in 1989, but it was never released. But canceled its release during the legal battle between Nintendo and Atari. Basically, there are fewer than 10 copies that were manufactured for the Genesis.
I know you can get bootlegs of them. I've never in my life even seen a picture of a Tetris.
So yeah, you can get bootlegs of them. I don't know if you can get an actual cartridge. Probably not, then, if there's only 10 of them left. But yeah, because that was also put out by Atari, or it was planned to be put out by Atari, licensing to Sega. But eventually, Nintendo becomes the only company that can put out Tetris. And of course, they use Tetris to massive success with the release of the Game Boy, which came as a pack-in with Tetris. And I mean, that skyrockets the Game Boy. I'm sure probably somewhere around half of the Game Boys only ever played Tetris in their entire life, because people would buy it and just play Tetris. That was, I mean, it's such a good game, and it's such a game that you can play anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, it's a good time waster.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the only time I ever remember playing Tetris was on the Game Boy.
Yeah, I mean, the Game Boy, maybe a DS. I'm going to just name a bunch of Nintendo products.
Yeah, that's true.
Even my cell phone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of outside of Nintendo platforms. I mean, a lot of the Sega stuff, they have their own version of Tetris, the Columns or whatever, which is Bejeweled.
Oh, yeah.
They called it Columns. So you have that, and you have other games, but I think Tetris does kind of stay towards Nintendo platforms. I think there might have been one on the Saturn, like a Tetris 3D or something.
Well, you could see all the other type of games that have come out that basically copy the idea of Tetris.
Right. It's
slightly different, though, like how you mentioned Bejeweled, and even games you could throw in, like Candy Crush in there.
Sure.
Well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bejeweled and whatever. Yeah, Candy Crush is another one. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those games that just becomes, I think it just becomes synonymous with the console. At least I think most people, when they think of the Game Boy, they think of it with that Tetris cartridge, right?
Yeah, Tetris or Pokemon or something.
Or Pokemon, yeah.
Yeah, for me, it was definitely Pokemon.
That's true. But whenever you see it, it's packaged with it. So it's one of those games. And I think it, I don't know, it makes it kind of interesting with the, that it's so associated with the home market. We haven't really talked about the arcade version.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I love the arcade version. The arcade version is released in 1988. I had already been exposed to whatever the home version was at the time, but I did really enjoy the version of it in the arcade. But not a lot of people were exposed to it in the arcade because it was so hot on the Game Boy and on Nintendo, as you were saying. I think, I want to say the Game Boy sold 40 or 50 million units because of it. Like, that's probably what Tetris did for the Game Boy. Because of that was such a successful pack-in that came with your Game Boy. Did the Game Boy retail for $200 or $100 when it was first released? I have to look that up.
I don't know. I feel it was definitely the more affordable option compared to the other video game developers.
Oh yeah, I mean compared to the Game Gear, it was half the price or something.
Or TurboGrafx.
Or the Lynx.
It was $89.99. So $89.99, about $100.
Yeah.
I know when the Lynx was put out afterwards, it being a color version of a handheld, that was $199.99. It was double the price. So for $100, you know, and what is it, 6 or 8 batteries in the backup
thing? Yeah,
exactly. I think it's 6.
Yeah.
6 batteries in backup thing. You could have your kid entertained on a long road trip with just playing Tetris. And a lot of people I've spoken to who received a Game Boy when they were younger, that's the only game they played.
Yeah.
It's the only game they had, and it's the only game they played. They didn't actually collect many other games besides
that's what came in the box. Yeah, exactly. That's what came in the box. Yeah, and I mean, I think that game kind of highlights the success of the Game Boy because it's a simple game. It doesn't need a whole lot of graphical abilities. It doesn't need color, which, you know, is what the selling point of the Game Gear and the Lynx was. Something like Columns, which is on the Game Gear, is their version. You do need color for that because it's like Bejeweled. It's different color.
Right.
Jewels or whatever. But Tetris, I think, highlights that idea of the Game Boy, which is that you don't need incredible graphics. You don't need color even. You just need a screen that you can see and, you know, a good game. And that's what Tetris is.
Yeah, it's more about function.
Yeah,
like over
exactly.
Beauty.
And that's how you get, instead of 4 hours of battery life, like 14 that the original Game Boy does or something.
And then what comes out of Tetris is exactly what you said, that Columns, whatever. But I always felt like at the time what came out of Tetris was Dr. Mario.
Oh, sure.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember that being people being insane over that game. And I'm going to be honest with you guys right now. I've never played a game of Dr. Mario.
Really?
I've never played that game.
That's great. Dr. Mario's fire.
Yeah, I really like that game.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. It's definitely a different feeling game than than Tetris, but you can't tell me that it wasn't heavily inspired by Tetris.
Doesn't it have an arcade version too?
Dr. Mario?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's on that. What's that cabinet, the Super Nintendo cabinet that we have?
No, we have F-Zero, okay. Super Mario World, and...
Yeah, I thought it was on one of those little... What about the one that's on the cart? Not the standard
people
ones,
have
the little side ones?
Put them into Versus systems.
Okay.
So, yeah, I've seen people make Dr. Mario cabinets, which is kind of cool. I've also seen people make... a freaking Zelda cabinet.
Well, yeah, that's
but
true.
I don't know. It could have been. It's very possible it was released to the Versus cabinet and the Versus system as a select game.
Maybe.
So, yeah, I believe that was an actual thing in the arcade.
Speaking of video game music, Dr. Mario's got some of my favorite video game music in it.
Yeah, I have heard the music. I definitely have heard the music. And speaking of music in general, the Tetris music, Chris, you were saying something before. It came out of, it's like a Russian folk song, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the Tetris, I think it's Tetris Theme A on the Game Boy.
Yeah.
Frankly, it's one of the most recognizable.
No, definitely.
It is.
Themes.
It is.
I'm more of a Type C one.
Really?
That one's good. It's a little bit more atmospheric.
I think it's a song called Korobeniki.
Yes.
Korobeniki?
Yeah, and it's like a Russian folk song.
Yeah, dating back a long ways, actually.
Yeah. So, of course, they put it in their tile-based puzzle game.
Hell yeah. The only thing that would have made it better if it was the USSR national anthem.
Well, that's D. They didn't include it in the main version.
Oh, yeah, yep. It's only available in the Soviet
version. On the Soviet version, on the PDP-11 or whatever, the Electronica 60.
It's a 19th century Russian folk song. Tells the story of a meeting between a peddler and a girl, describing their haggling over goods in a metaphor for courtship. So that's kind of interesting.
There you go.
I guess
Tetris.
That's fitting with the entire story of, you know, giving up the licensing and all that as well.
That's true.
It's widely known as the Tetris theme, titled A-Type in the game.
There you go.
From its appearance in Nintendo's 1989 Game Boy version.
There you go. So it's all about haggling over intellectual property rights.
Yeah. And you know what? You got to feel bad for Pajetnov. You got to feel bad for him because he gets...
Oh, he's getting screwed every which
way. He gets nothing out of this at all until way later down the line, I believe it's like in the 90s, mid-90s, where some of the rights... Now, in 91, he emigrates to the United States, so he leaves the Soviet Union behind. I believe right after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I believe around 96 that Hank Rogers somehow figures out a way to get him the rights back. They formed the Tetris company and then they manage the rights to Tetris now on all platforms because all of the other agreements that were made by the Soviet Union with Nintendo and whoever else, they've all expired. So now Pajetnov makes royalty for each Tetris game or derivative of Tetris that is sold worldwide. But you had to wait from 1984 all the way till 1996 for any sort of, you know, monetary recognition.
He also made nearly like a dozen runoff games based on Tetris that all have names based on like Tetris. Like he uses Tet and then he throws on like another name at the end of it.
Or, well, there's also Hattress.
Yeah, Hattress.
Where you, make, and, yeah, you exactly. have to do hats or whatever.
They're hats?
Yeah, yep. The blocks are like hats and you have to stack as many hats on the guy's head as you can or something.
Yep.
But again, it is one of those games that transcends all generations. Everybody can play Tetris.
Oh, yeah.
And another thing is that, you know, after the Game Boy, it just goes on. It becomes a juggernaut with the Game Boy, but then a juggernaut in the Nintendo Entertainment System. But I can remember my first, like, real color mobile phone, cell phone, that Tetris was, like, built into this.
Oh, yeah. For some reason, it always has like, Snake and Tetris on it. Those are, like, the two games that you get on every
phone.
But think about that. Like, you could get, you know, in the 2000s as well, you know, when iPods were still a thing. They're not anymore because we have iPhones. Mm-hmm. But Tetris was on those as well, on the color iPod stuff. Yeah. On the iTouches and stuff like that. But it is just, it's like what you said. It's literally, you can get it on any freaking system right now.
Yeah.
And long awaited. I mean, you know, he had to deal with all those legal challenges in order to get his end of the cut, which is what he deserved to begin with. 15
versions and stuff, yeah.
So it's a good thing that, you know, this story ends in proper terms where he was given what he was owed.
Yeah, no, agreed. I also just think it's a fascinating story because it's so freaking murky. The rights of this game, because it's developed in the Soviet Union, on a computer that the Soviet government technically owns at the time, right? You know, he's using their software on their time, and he's, you know, he single-handedly basically creates one of the biggest games the world has ever seen, if not, honestly, the biggest, because it definitely, in my mind, its success and its how recognizable it is rivals anything else I can even think of. It rivals Mario, it rivals Pac-Man, it rivals Space Invaders, it rivals Pong. It probably even goes beyond all of those.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the whole grand scheme of things, I would argue that Tetris is the most like recognizable game to anybody, no matter what age you are, no matter where you're from in the world. Because I remember when we were talking about Nintendo and like Super Mario, and there's a handful of classics, but Tetris, for the fact that it's on, I think we were talking about Breakout, I want to say. It was either Breakout or it was something like that. And we were saying how it was on Nokias, it was on like Blackberries and stuff. Tetris was on all of them and more.
Yeah.
And it still will be for years to come.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's back to that simple design that we've mentioned before on the podcast, where it's a very simple game, very easy to pick up on and play. And as we've seen once again, the easier the game is to play and the easier it is to pick up, the easier it is to really sell.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the most advanced game. It's not the most visually grabbing, but it's simple and it's fun to play. And I think it has good music, which I think is part of it.
Definitely adds to it.
Yeah. Should we talk about the murder-suicide?
Yeah, let's definitely.
Okay.
I love getting to stuff like that, and I had no clue of that story.
Went into the murky waters and the deal with the Soviet Union. Now it gets even worse.
Yeah. So this is a story that I heard on some random podcast like 10 years ago. And I remember just thinking how crazy it was. And I haven't heard it much elsewhere. But this is a story associated with Alexei Pajitnov, a man by the name of Vladimir Ivanovich Pakilko. He was born in the Soviet Union. He was another academic who also got into game design. He was a computer programmer. He, I think, had a degree in psychology from Moscow University, and he worked with Pozhitnov doing Tetris. He had his own video game company that developed, I think, only one game, which was like a fish tank simulator, and then went under. He ended up in the United States, in California, and on, let me try to find the date here. I believe the date was 21st September 1998. He murdered his wife and son. He stabbed them both to death and then committed suicide by slitting his own throat and left behind a suicide note. They don't know exactly if he was the one who wrote it, but it's heavily suspected. And the suicide notes reads, "I've been eaten alive, Vladimir. Just remember that I am exist, the devil."
I am exist.
The devil, spelled D-A-V-I-L, interestingly. Damn. So that's a kind of insane story to be associated with Tetris. And I think, speaking of Hattris, I believe he was more involved with the creation of Hattris. I think he did some coding work for it.
Interesting.
So, you know, think about the game Tetris and then think about a murder-suicide with a suicide note mentioning the devil. Kind of like a completely insane story associated with, again, one of the most famous games of all time. And not many people know about it, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to like the Pac-Man like murder.
Right,
Where it's, the Pac-Man one's definitely more well-known.
Right.
But I feel like it still comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, the thing to me about this one that's even more like kind of striking, I guess, is that it's not just some guy who like played Pac-Man or whatever, or killed someone Pac-Man.
The developer.
It was a co-developer. He was you know, cited as the co-creator of Tetris in a couple places. So apparently Forbes magazine in 1999 credited him with co-inventing the seminal game Tetris. Wow. So apparently Forbes magazine thinks he was the co-inventor. And, you know, he murdered his wife and killed himself.
I mean, dude, he was working on, Hattris.
There you go, yeah. So, it's just a crazy story.
And what I would like to mention here is that there was a deep scare in the past couple of years with parents, you know, worrying about their kids playing games like Grand Theft Auto or very gory games like Call of Duty and things like that. Games that are heavily into violence. This is just Tetris.
Right, exactly.
It's like Tetris.
No, exactly. It's one of the most relaxing games you could possibly pick up, and this is the story that goes along with it, which is interesting.
Even about that murder over Pac-Man. It's like, Pac-Man's not the most violent game you could think of.
Well, I definitely would say this Tetris one is a little bit more of, like, you're getting the developer side, so it's more of the stress of this guy, like, making the game.
Right, that's fair.
And who knows? Maybe he had some issues with the whole, like the lawsuit where they're trying to get the rights for it and he can't make any money off of this game.
Mm.
It could be something like that. But Pac-Man, it was more of, like, just some, like, the guy was just
like rageful. A barroom brawl type of thing.
Yeah, the guy was just like, I want to play Pac-Man. Nope, all right, I'll be right back.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing was he was trying to kind of make it as his own. I don't know if it was a gaming company or more just like a software development company, and that wasn't really working out. So I think that was definitely part of it. And I'm sure part of it was that he wasn't getting any money from Tetris, which he saw everywhere around him by 1999. And, you know, he wasn't getting a penny of it, even though he worked hard on it. And I mean, even Alexei, his friend, probably wasn't getting much money from it. So,
when was this, like the murder case?
This is 1998.
All right, so it was a year before they even gave him recognition.
Right, yes.
Okay, yeah. I could see, like, the guy could have been getting absolutely no recognition.
Right.
The game's been fully developed then for, 14 years at
something
that point?
Something like that,
Give or take. Yeah, pretty much. And people are making money off it for the last 12, 13 years.
And
people
are making greedy Americans making money.
Right. And people are making big money off it as of 1988, 1987, 1988. People are making, companies are making huge money off this.
Yeah, well, everyone's making money except for Alexei, who I think had just moved to the U.S. by that point.
He moved to the U.S. in 1991, I believe.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. So earlier then. But yeah, everybody, you know, is making money except for the two of them pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, first released from Spectrum Holobyte for the personal computers, at that time, it sells for PCs between 1988 and 1990, I believe it sells 150,000 copies, which is like they make $6 million off it. No one's seeing money but the greedy software. Yeah, the greedy software companies, yeah. Yeah. And the Soviet government is obviously seeing money off it.
Right.
Yep.
So you're seeing just the government and the manufacturing companies that are seeing any profits from this, and the creators so little to nothing, at that time at least.
Yeah.
And it says here, in 6 months of its release in 1990, the Nintendo version had already sold 1.5 million copies, which equaled to $52 million at that time.
Damn.
That's on the NES, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How many does it sell on the Game Boy?
Game Boy bundles with Tetris, 6 months of its release, I believe it's 6 months of release, sell 2 million units.
Wow.
It's 2 million Game Boys move.
In 6 months.
Yeah. I mean, they had shorted the production numbers anyway on the Game Boy, so they were in trouble when they first launched it to begin with, because they didn't produce as many as they actually needed. The Nintendo version goes on to sell 7.5 million copies in the United States by 1992 and more than 20 million worldwide by 1996. They eventually sell a total of 35 million copies for the Game Boy. 35 million copies. That means
that is
35
crazy.
Million Game Boys.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it means.
Exactly.
Because if you were buying a Game Boy, you weren't buying Tetris separately because it came with it. So that's 35 million full units of Game Boy.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I
mean, is the Nintendo Game Boy the highest selling video gaming product ever made?
No.
I believe that's still the PlayStation 2, I believe.
Yeah.
Really?
It's
either the PS2 or the Wii.
I think it's the
PS2.
Ooh,
the Wii. The Wii sounds right.
And, well, and again, the reasons for it is good packing games. Although the thing about the PS2 is they sold it as a cheap DVD player.
Yeah.
So half of the people probably bought it just as a DVD player and never even played any games on it.
Yes. But also, PS2, when they released Final Fantasy VII on console...
Yeah.
That moves 14 million consoles for them right off the bat.
Yeah.
It says here it's PS2 is the best-selling system overall.
Yeah.
155 million units were sold worldwide.
Wow. That's absurd.
That's absurd.
Now, going back to the Game Boy, how much was the Game Boy originally sold for at the time with the
$89.99, I believe.
I wonder what year was the Game Boy released?
89.
Wow, I didn't know that it was around for that long now.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So $89 back in 89.
It's like
$250.
You're looking at around
probably. Something like that.
Maybe around $200 in today.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Right.
But you also got to realize, too, like that kind of came out, you know, they came out of the gate first. Even though it was black and white, I think its affordability and the actual pack-in with it being Tetris, even though it was just a black and white system, that's what moved that handheld. So when Game Gear came out and Atari Lynx came out and the portable TurboGrafx 16, the Turbo Express, which is a freaking badass handheld, I don't care what anyone says, they were priced more expensive, and yes, they were more advanced and they were color, and this beautiful little tiny little color screen on it, and that was their gimmick. They could not catch up to the Game Boy with the Tetris pack-in. Yeah. There was no way. Nintendo was already completely leveling everyone else and destroying everyone else's chances of releasing a high-tech handheld at that time.
I mean, we might be able to make a whole separate episode of just the handheld consoles on its own during that time.
Yeah, definitely. Of course. 100%. And as we're talking about with the music of Tetris, we could do we're going to do a whole other episode on entirely just on our arcade music itself.
Oh, God.
And the development over that, over you know, 30 years or 40 years.
Spy Hunter, just fantastic. Yep. Oh, yep. My God.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
All right, so I think we're ready to wrap it up.
Yeah.
All right, so thanks for listening to this episode from Russia with Love on Tetris. We hope you enjoyed, and we hope you check out some of our other episodes. We've got quite a backlog building up, so hopefully if you like this one, you'll go back and check out some of our older ones.
Thank you for tuning in to the Arcade Age Exhibit Podcast. I hope you enjoyed your time with our hosts, Seamus, Zach, Jake, Sean, Chris, and Jose. Tune in next week, and remember, the future is now.